I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome back.
So on our way to another segment in our countdown to the Annapolis Summit, we are about to talk to Doug Colbert, professor of law at the University of Maryland School of Law, about the decision made on September 25th by the highest court in Maryland that people have a right to a lawyer at their initial bail hearing, and what this means and what it will mean when we will be following this during the General Assembly is one of the big issues facing the General Assembly in this coming session in 2014. And, Doug, welcome back to the program.
Well, thank you, Mark. It's good to be here.
So talk about the significance of the decision on September 25th let's start there.
Well, Mark, it was a landmark, groundbreaking decision. It's one that the law students at Maryland Law School have been working on for the last 16 years with a tremendous collaboration with private lawyers and human rights organizations and legal groups. And what we started with was the idea that poor people, disproportionately African and Latino American and low-income people, do not have a lawyer when their most important human rights at stake, namely their freedom. And so we began in 1998 to focus on the lack of representation and also how money determines whether or not a person regains their liberty. And by that I mean that when a judge sets a bail, if you have the money, if you're wealthy or well-to-do, you will regain your liberty. But if you're poor or low-income, the chances are very good that you will remain in jail for the next 30 to 45 days on nonviolent crime. So that's where we started from. Without going through the whole history, the decision that the Court of Appeals made on September 25th of this year indicated that poor people have a constitutional right to a lawyer when they first appear before a commissioner. And that has never been held before in this state. So there's two things that are going to be happening during the legislative session that may lead to a very different and more just pretrial system. One is that poor people will be represented at their first hearing. And secondly, there has been a proposal to reduce the reliance on money bail and to replace it with an objective assessment of whether or not somebody is a flight risk or is a significant danger to the community. Now, while both of these proposals are going to be before the legislature, one of them, the constitutional right to a lawyer, has already been decided, and yet, as we talk today, poor people are still unrepresented by a lawyer, and many will spend their entire month of December, and including Thanksgiving, but they'll be spending Christmas and New Year's in jail because they don't have somewhere between $100 and $1,000.
So let me understand this. Let's understand this as we enter this discussion today. The decision made on September 25th cover both the things you just talked about? The right.
No,
to
it just covered the constitutional right to a lawyer.
Okay.
The other was covered by the governor's pretrial task force, which has been meeting for 2 years, and that will be a proposal that the full task force will consider, and I expect that the legislature will examine as well in terms of whether or not we can stop conditioning freedom on whether you have money, but rather whether or not you're going to return to court and that you're not going to engage in violent behavior against other people.
So there'll be two separate issues. One, let me just go through this again with you here. Mm-hmm. The issue of the right to a lawyer at bail is now a constitutional right, but the debate will be, clearly it seems to me, the debate will be how it is funded, how much it costs, how to implement it. That's what the debate will be.
There is no debate on that, Mark. When you have a constitutional right, it's not a question of whether the government can find the money. The government is obligated, mandated, to find the money. And so what's most disturbing and disappointing right now is that 10 weeks after the highest court in our state declared a constitutional right, the executive and legislative branches have not acted to enforce, to protect people's rights. And again, the people who are in jail, they are going to be low-income, poor, disproportionately African-American. They are the people who, for the most part, maintain our pretrial population. People who have money, they regain their liberty within the first 24 hours. So it's difficult to understand how our constitutional system appears to be breaking down. And it's disturbing as a lawyer to see the Attorney General move for a delay until next July 1st and for the governor to remain silent on this issue, for legislators not to be saying that, of course, we're going to find the money. And I should add that funding the public defender will result in substantial cost savings from not requiring that people spend 30 to 45 days in jail when they have, when they're accused of having a marijuana joint or driving without a license or engaging in petty shoplifting. And taxpayers, we are the ones who are left paying the bill. So this is one of those situations when you have a constitutional right, the rest of government is obligated to implement that right. And that's what's so disturbing right now, is that people seem to be waiting for a discussion that should have been had any time within the last 7 years since we filed this lawsuit.
And the I think the other piece of this we'll talk about during the course of this discussion today on the program later and over the coming weeks is the risk assessment. Risk assessment is a huge part of this, because that in itself would, I mean, that's a threat, I would think, to people in the bail bonds industry and other lawyers because of the money made on bonds. And people will argue about the ethical efficacy of it as well. But that's a separate issue, but it grows out of this decision.
Absolutely. It would be a major change in not conditioning liberty on whether you have the money. And frankly, in all the years that I've practiced law and taught law, I have never truly understood the connection between having $1,000 to give to a bondsman on a $10,000 bond and being able to say to the judge, Your Honor, I will return to court when required. I've never missed a court appearance. I have strong community ties. And that's what the risk assessment is about. It's saying that if you do have a good record for showing up in court and you don't have convictions for violence, that you stand an excellent chance of being released and not paying a bail bondsman a 10% non-refundable fee.
Well, Doug Colbert, I appreciate the time today and look forward to our continuing conversation on this critical issue.
Well, I thank you. I hope by the next time we speak, Mark, that poor people do have counsel, and I'm even optimistic that that's going to happen in the month of December so that folks do not have to spend their holidays away from family and inside the Central Booking Jail and the other jails in our state.
Thank you, Doug.
Thank you, sir.
Now we're about to talk to Scott Schellenberger, of course, is the Baltimore County State's Attorney, as we kind of wind our way through talking about the right to everyone to have a lawyer at their first bail hearing that was decided by the state's highest court on September the 25th. And it's caused a huge conversation in our community. And Scott, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Thanks, Mark. Thanks for having me on.
And let's count down to the Annapolis Summit. This will be one of the discussions happening in Annapolis during this session. So your take, so now we have a constitutional right to have a lawyer at bail at your first bail hearing.
That's correct. That's
right?
What the Court of Appeals ruled.
Right. The question would be, well, if it's a constitutional right, then the only problem is how to implement it. How do we start it?
And that's the huge problem, is implementation. The initial suggestion last spring when this was being discussed was that the public defender's office would just have to man all these bail hearings. The problem is, when we started counting up the number of hours and the number of places and locations where they'd have to be, The fiscal price tag was put at somewhere in the area of $30 million just for the public defender's office to hire 240 assistant public defenders to sit at these commissioner offices to handle all these bail hearings. Every year, about 177,000 of these bail hearings take place. And when you start thinking about manning them 24/7, the fiscal cost just becomes enormous.
But if it is a constitutional guaranteed right now, it has to be met somehow, correct?
That's correct. And so a lot of people are putting their heads together to try and come up with a way to comply with the court's ruling, but try and do it without spending $30 million.
Well, I have two questions out of that. One, I'm curious, were you were not part of this. Were you part of this brief at all before the Supreme Court on one side or the other?
No,
the appeals court, one side or the other?
No, I wasn't. The appeals were handled by the Attorney General's office, very ably handled by them. And they were actually representing the defendants in this case, who are actually the head of the district court system, and also the commissioners, and also the public defender, in which the plaintiffs claimed that the public defender should be there, and also that the court should be letting lawyers in for these hearings.
So what is your take? I'm curious two things. Let me just start with, what is your interpretation of the law and your take on the law and what it will entail? I'm very curious whether you would support it or disagree legally with the decision.
Well, I disagree with the decision, Mark. I think it's just goes a little bit too far. In the state of Maryland, when you get arrested, the statistics show that 50% or more, 50 to 55% of defendants are typically released on recog, and they're usually, and that's on their own recognizance. They don't have to put money up. They don't need a lawyer. And that typically happens in about 3 to 5 hours. What we're doing is we're basically going to spend money giving lawyers to about 60 to 70,000 people who really haven't needed one up to this point. There's another group of defendants, about 7,000, maybe to 8,000 across the state, who we're going to be giving lawyers to, who they can't be let out because the legislature has decided that those individuals are charged with such serious crimes, they can only be let out by a judge. Now, in Maryland, if you don't get let out by the commissioner, you do get a hearing within about 24 hours, and you do have a public defender at that hearing. So my argument has always been that we really are providing a lawyer and a judge to them in a relatively short period of time. There are many states in this country where you don't get any of that at all. There are many states where that doesn't happen for 48 or 72 hours. So I think Maryland is already ahead of the game, and that this is an incredible waste of resources trying to move that adversary hearing up right when a person is initially arrested.
Some people argue, as you know, we saw in some of the editorials, people who argued this case and in the editorials were arguing that that the system itself, they're saying, is arbitrary and it's, I think, as Doug Culver wrote about, wrote skewed to the favor of the well-off. If you're accused of being an armed trafficker and make $1 million bond, if you have the money, you can get out. But if you are a nickel-and-dime drug dealer in Baltimore Central Booking or Baltimore County, you're stuck in $1,500 bail and you can't get out. And that's what this new law is designed for, to ensure that everyone has a right to a lawyer to defend them at that point. So if they can get on their own recognizance or for less money, that would be guaranteed in this new system.
I do not deny that the cash bail system that is currently operated here in Maryland can somewhat skew to helping individuals who can raise money or spend money to get out of jail. The problem is this misperception that, you know, a whole bunch of people who are charged with possession of marijuana or shoplifting are sitting in my detention center or in the Baltimore City detention center. It just isn't accurate. The facts upon which the Richmond case were based occurred back in the early 2000s when Baltimore City was mass arresting individuals in the tune of about 100,000 people a year. You know, they have changed that strategy down there. And in fact, last year, I believe only about 55,000 individuals were being arrested. And so I think the facts under which the Richmond decision is based is flawed because nobody is really operating that kind of zero-tolerance, arrest-everybody system. And, in fact, we've made some other great progress in the state. Last year and 2 years ago, the legislature approved a number of laws that in which you can give a person a citation, so they don't even go to the commissioner. So simple possession of marijuana, small quantities. You don't go to a commissioner. You don't get bail. They basically hand you a ticket and tell you to show up for court. So I think we've made a lot of strides, and I just think this is a step too far.
So what do you think the outcome will be? What are you discussing now at these legislative committee hearings now about how to implement this rule?
Well, one of the things we've discussed is adopting an objective risk assessment criteria that can be quickly filled out. They just put it into effect in Kentucky in July, in which basically ministerial people answer 7 questions based on your criminal history, and those answers will rate you as to whether you're a low risk to show up for trial or commit another crime, or a high risk. And one of the models that we're looking at is that individuals who are low risk will be immediately recogged, won't be involved in the cash bail system, and they'll be given a court date. Hopefully this will take so many people out of the judicial bail hearings that will be able to cut down on the number of public defenders or lawyers who will have to be hired to represent him. In addition, there's talk that maybe the commissioners won't do bail reviews anymore, that you only get 1 bail review instead of 2, and that'll happen the next day in front of a judge at which you will have a lawyer. That would also cut down on the costs, but it would also force judges to sit on weekends and holidays. And certainly that's something that I think a lot of people are going to need to look at.
Well, Scott Schellenberger, I appreciate you taking time out of your busy schedule on your way to Annapolis here today, Baltimore County State's Attorney. And we look forward in the coming weeks before our Annapolis Summit and during the session to talk with you a great deal more about this issue and about the risk assessments that will be coming up as well.
Well, thanks very much, Mark, for taking an interest.
Thank you so much, Scott.
Take care.
Bye-bye. We're about to talk to John McCarthy, who is the Montgomery County State's Attorney. John McCarthy, welcome. Good to have you with us here on the Mark Steiner Show.
Thank you.
So tell us, I mean, there's been so much consternation, it seems, over this. On the 25th of September, the Court of Appeals mandated that constitutionally people have a right to a lawyer at bail. So why is there opposition to this? Why is there, it feels like people are kind of trying to find ways to push it back and not implement it. I mean, how do you analyze?
I think the largest concern is the reality of the price tag that comes with it. And I think that conservatively, we're talking about $500 million over the next 10 years for the combined cost of public defenders, state attorneys, security, hard building costs, or construction costs that would go into making the locations where these bond reviews take place suitable and safe for them to take place with an increased numbers of people being present. So I think there is the cost. The reality is I think there are a number of other alternative solutions that are fair. I am very much in favor of what the idea that I believe is being floated and being considered by the governor in a bill I think that he will be proposing is that we take out of the equation the commissioners in their role in setting bonds and basically instead insert a case management or pretrial screening unit that uses a risk assessment tool that is based on social science research that is both racially and ethnically blind, and therefore we would be assuring using this risk assessment tool that we would retain in custody those who need to be retained for the public safety of the public, but releasing anyone else where that's not a necessity before they're tried.
But does that abrogate the right for somebody to have a right of a lawyer at their first bail hearing? Isn't that
there won't be
law?
A bailing. No. They're literally what happens. If you got arrested, you would be taken in, assuming you were taken into custody. When you are arrested, you'd be taken before a pretrial services worker who would fill out a risk assessment instrument based on the nature of the crime you committed and your criminal history, failures to appear, whether you're on probation, all those kinds of things. and they score it. And that's what happens. And what you have in the questions and the criteria on the risk assessment instrument are based on criteria that have been tested by researchers across the United States of America to determine what are the factors that really make a person, the real factors that make someone a risk to their community. What are the real factors that tell us that a person is less likely to come back and come to court when they're asked to come to court, so that we are making more intelligent decisions about who is detained and who is released. It is estimated that when that form is filled out, 65 to 70% of the people are walking right out the door. They're going to sign their name and they're going home. 30% will be detained the next day within 24 hours. I think what I would propose is that within 24 hours, and I wouldn't even include weekends, we would have the brief, we would have hearings the next day for that 30% that are not released.
John McCarthy, I appreciate your time. It's been a really interesting perspective on this, a fresh one. Montgomery County State's Attorney, it's been a pleasure to have you with us.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you. John, that was great. I appreciate it.
Okay. Well, look, I hope you can cut. We use these risk assessment instruments already. The number of people detained will be about the same percentage as before, and we're using social science to get it done.
That's the other part of the another bill that's being introduced, apparently, is around the whole question of risk assessment and changing the nature of how we do bail.
That's exactly right. We literally are revolutionizing the way we do it, reducing substantially the cost, and using science to help us come up with a better way of doing business.
I hope you'll come back on our show. Look forward to it.
Okay, thanks.
Thanks so much, John. Take care.
Bye.
Bye-bye. Okay. I'm about to talk to Tim Murray, who is the Executive Director of Pretrial Justice Institute, joining us from Annapolis right now. Tim, good to have you with us.
Thank you for having me.
Tim, I'm curious your response. There's so much back and forth about this, and as we've said in the other segments, there's been a lot, even though this has become a constitutional right to have a lawyer at bail, there's been a lot of opposition to it and finding ways to get around it or to kind of ameliorate the decision in some way or abrogate the decision in some way, I should say. So one of the things that we just heard was that this is costing too much money. And what we need to do is create a risk assessment tool that scientifically assesses people, and that would ensure that 60-70% of the people would get out anyway. What's your response to that?
Well, I think it's a step in the right direction, Mark. It's not the ultimate destination, but it is a powerful and important initial move away from Maryland's current system of determining who stays in jail and who gets to go home pending the outcome of their case. And as you know, that current system is predicated solely on how many dollars are in the pocket of the accused, a premise that you and I both know neither assures appearance in court nor guarantees community safety. To assess the risk of flight and the risk of further criminal activity of individuals using an unbiased, validated objective risk tool provides our system with a couple of opportunities. One, it allows our systems to identify the lowest risk individuals and to gain consensus among prosecutors, defenders, and the court that these individuals don't have to be held. They don't have to be put into a cell. They can be released upon booking and identification, and that's going to relieve the court system of a tremendous amount of business. But this risk assessment that the state attorney referred to has a shelf life beyond that initial decision as well. For those individuals who are in medium or higher risk, that risk score then accompanies them to the bail setting hearing, and it's a platform upon which both the prosecutor and the defender make their arguments, and ultimately the judge makes his or her decision.
So, but what does that all mean in terms of what is right for the indigent defendant who now has to go before a commissioner? Again, this would do away with commissioners in some ways, that people say. Instead, they would have this assessment.
Well, as far as what this means to indigent defendants, it means that the vast majority of them will no longer be punished because of their indigency. In fact, they will be released for the most part unless they provide a measured risk of flight or reoffense. Most defendants who get arrested wind up in the middle of these risk scales. They are medium risk. That's the definition of the category medium. But there are thousands upon thousands who are currently being held who are the lowest risk of any measured defendant in the system, yet they're being held regardless of that risk because they can't afford to post bond, as you know. To be able to release these individuals upon booking and identification not only relieves the system of an awful lot of work and human traffic, it also deals fairly with those arrested and rids our system of its current bias in favor of the wealthy and the privileged.
So where do you think this ends up politically? What's going to happen?
Geez, I wish I knew. I can tell you what I hope is going to happen, and that is that the stakeholders and policymakers in our state embrace the science and the tools science has developed in terms of risk assessment, that decision makers will take these tools and put them to good use, and that we will once and for all abandon this hypocrisy that we have in our state called money bail, which simply discriminates against those who have not and favor those who have, regardless where that second group may have come by their cash.
Tim Murray, Executive Director of Pretrial Justice Institute, thank you so much for taking your time with us here on the Countdown to the Annapolis Summit today.
Thank you, Mark. Stay well.
You're listening to The Mark Steiner Show, Public Radio WEAA, 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. Don't go away. We'll be right back after this very short break.
Welcome back. We are going to continue our conversation here on The Mark Steiner Show on our Countdown to the Annapolis Summit, looking at the question of lawyers of the bail, which is now a constitutional right, so says the Court of Appeals here, the highest court in the state of Maryland, and look at what these risk assessments means in terms of bails and how that affects the bail bond industry and affects the people itself. We're here with Chris Floor. Chris Floor practices criminal defense attorney in Severna Park in the law firm of Blackford and Floor. But he was the former legal director of the Lawyers at Bail Project, where we first met, where he supervised a group of lawyers and paralegals and now provide representation at the Baltimore City Bail Review hearings for the indigent. We are also joined by Ricardo Flores by phone. Ricardo Flores is director of government relations for the Maryland Office of the Public Defender, and Tom Moronic, who is a criminal defense attorney and radio host of the Tom Moore Show on AM 680 WCBM. Good to have you all with us.
Thank you.
Did I just say another radio station on my own show? I don't know. I shouldn't have done that, but we did.
I won't tell anyone.
Welcome to have you all with us.
Thank you.
Let's begin with, we've heard earlier from Scott Schellenberger, who's a state's attorney from Baltimore County, who really opposed this ruling, still does, and Doug Holbert, clearly, who has been leading the charge for this for many years. And so this is now a constitutional right to have a lawyer at a bail hearing. Let me start with you, Tom. So why do you think there's so much consternation over this issue of this constitutional right now to a lawyer at a bail hearing?
I think it's because it's an unfunded mandate. They basically said you have to have this procedurally, but we're not going to create any apparatus to create funding for it. And Ricardo can get into more of that, but really the public defender's office is scrambling because they don't have the resources.
Ricardo?
Well, that's right. I guess I do want to lend a little bit of perspective in terms of the absolute amount we're talking about. The public defender, obviously, in preparation for potential implementation of this mandate, has run our budgets by both the Department of Budget and Management, Department of Legislative Services. And it's been out in the media that the amount we're talking about is about $30 million. That's 0.1% of our budget in the state of Maryland. We're a $35 billion economy. This is not a question of where is the money coming from so much as do we want to reallocate that amount of funds to this particular purpose rather than for something else. And I would say, obviously, Because we're a constitutionally mandated agency and because we believe in the directives of the Constitution, we think it's well worth spending that amount.
Chris, now how do you see this? I mean, this is your perspective.
I'm happy.
Let me get you a little closer to the mic.
Sure. I'm really happy because I came to Maryland about 15 or so years ago when we started the Vail Project in Baltimore. And at the time, no one really even dreamed of having a lawyer at the bail review hearing, let alone the commissioner hearing. And the first round of Richmond, I watched a court of appeals that just roundly shut the lawyers down who argued the brief for the change. No one was ready for it. No one thought it was possible logistically or that it was necessary. There's been a culture for a long time that really the meat of a case is the trial, and that's where you need to have the lawyer. So as long as the lawyer is there for the trial, we're all good. And in Fenner, the Court of Appeals had decided prior to the latest Richmond decision that a person didn't need to be represented at the bail review hearing, and that defendant had confessed to the crime, explaining that he sold drugs because he was an addict and he wanted help. And in that unrepresented moment, that little snippet of a tape was played at his trial, and he was sentenced to state prison as a result of it. And that was just a handful of years ago. So now, having watched the more recent Richmond oral argument, it was a completely different landscape. And it's nice to see that amongst my own colleagues that there's been a change of heart about this, more of an embracing of the issue. And I can see that everyone knew that this was going to be difficult when it came, and this is certainly not something that is taking the legal community by storm at the last minute. This has been in the works for over a decade, that legislative litigation, all these different attacks have been made to raise that this is an issue. In fact, before the latest Richmond decision, when the Maryland rule went into effect about this, many of the legislators, and I was there for those hearings, said, well, if we, you know, shut this down as many of the opponents were trying to shut it down, they said, well, what if the Court of Appeals comes back and tells us it's a constitutional issue? We're going to have to do this anyway. And now they finally have. And having been doing this for over 20 years, anytime there's any change, there's always going to be resistance. But for me, my perspective is this is just such a fundamental right, just a basic right to have someone representing you.
So there's been resistance to this from the very beginning. I've had debates on this for the last 15 years or more on this program, maybe 20 years. And part of that resistance is it's not needed. Scott Schellenberg said in this program just a little while ago that 55% of all the people who come through the Baltimore County Detention Center are released within hours on their own recog. And people argue that's not true. Some people argue it is true. So the question is, A, you know, so people are – is part of the resistance that people say, okay, you might make this constitutional, but we don't think it's necessary, so we're going to try to hold it up for as long as humanly possible because we don't want to do this. Is that part of the politics of what we're seeing?
I think absolutely when you saw the oral argument and with the response of requesting a task force, with requesting time to implement the court's ruling, that the court looked out at the AG's office, and I believe there was a separate attorney representing the public defender's office at the time, and said, no, we're just not prepared to do that. This is not going to be something we're going to delay.
I could see how the court came up with the ruling. I could see how they feel it's necessary. But I agree with Scott Schellenberger about that. I talked to an attorney in Annapolis earlier today who said that he represented somebody one time at a commissioner hearing. He said he waited around for 3 hours, finally got out at about 1 a.m, and just had to sit there. And he's been practicing a long time, said he had done it once in his entire career. So I understand the court's position, but I tend to agree with Scott as far as this goes.
So what would it mean if this – let's say – I mean the argument is that clearly what it feels like there's the governor's office is being very quiet, at least in the front. But behind the scenes, some people are arguing that they're working to limit this. We've heard the attorney general wants to put it all off to July the 1st. That's one of the things you hear out of the attorney general's office. I haven't seen anything on paper, but that's what you hear coming out of their office. So how does this happen, Ricardo? I mean, how does, A, if this is a constitutional right, then how does it get implemented? What happens? What's going to happen here?
Well, you know, as Paul, the public defender, Paul DeWolf for the state of Maryland, has said already several times, we are ready, willing, and able to implement. If your question is how do we operationalize this, the public defender's office is obviously already a statewide entity that has experience and expertise in indigent defense. And adding this step to our representation allows us to represent individuals, indigent individuals, pretty much from tip to tip. There's a lot of practical synergies that we could benefit, and I think that would benefit the entire criminal justice system by having us in this earlier stage of the process. The mechanics of it is that we need to get an authorization to begin spending money for that purpose, and then technically we get what's called a deficiency in the budget to make up for the funds that nobody could have anticipated we would have needed to spend for this, you know, sort of new particular type of representation. If I can just respond really quickly to what Schellenberger is saying, I agree. There's 50% of the people that get released at the commissioner stage. That's not a deficit. That's clearly a benefit to the system that diverts those people from further temporary detention in local facilities as they either wait for a bail review sometime later, which could be anywhere from a day later, ideally, to 2, 3, 4 days later, depending on whether it's a weekend or a holiday, 3 to 4 day weekend. And so the costs of detention are sort of a countervailing cost and consideration when you talk about our two-step system. It's not intuitive to think of two steps as being more efficient than one, but because so many people do get out on recognizance at that first step, it's actually a really cost-saving part of our process. So, you know, there's a lot of different ideas, but people really have to put all of the pieces together to understand how the system currently works and whether one tweak is going to be adverse or positive in terms of creating efficiency.
Mark, if I could just jump in 1 second. I'm not surprised that Tom's colleague said that he had only represented one person at a commissioner hearing. The clients and the families don't know to ask for it because it's not the norm. And so it is unusual up to this point, even though the rule has recognized for a long time that the commissioner is obligated to hear from the defense counsel if they're present. But I've done a number of those hearings at all different hours of the night and day, and I would say that it really does make a difference. It really absolutely does, because at that point, unlike the bail review hearing where they'll have pretrial, they'll often have a prosecutor, the commissioner has no information whatsoever other than that charging document. That's it. And they don't have any recommendation about their family and so forth. The only person they're listening to is the defendant themselves report where they're living, where they're working. And we all know what the system's looking like when they're talking to a criminal defense. They're going to presume everything they're telling them is not true. So having an advocate who comes in, who verifies information, who presents letters, who presents treatment information, all those things have made a huge difference to my clients. And that continuity of representation that Ricardo was talking about a moment ago, it really is a benefit, because having been a former public defender in New York, I can tell you the toughest job a public defender faces is not a trial of a really difficult case. It's gaining a client's trust, gaining a client's trust of someone that did not select you, that thinks that you are working against them for the system, and to earn that trust. And when you're in there from the very first moment, then you have a much better chance to gain that trust, just as the New York system has done for quite a long time.
Tom, logically, what's wrong with that, with what Chris is describing?
It certainly helps as far as the process, having someone there, and I don't disagree with anything he said. The issue is, as Scott said, there's so many people who get out on recognizance. It's for that, you know, select few, I'll say, comparatively.
Half,
but some of those will still get that check and balance review. I mean, I don't have any problem with it, but my issue is if the public defender is going to be tasked to do it, making sure that they have those resources, because Ricardo just said it's a deficiency. So that money's got to come from somewhere, because as he said, they didn't expect it.
Well, let me talk about the money on two levels here for a minute. A, before we get to a little bit on the risk assessment, which we'll do more in another show with more intensity but and more focus, but there have been all kinds of studies about how much it costs to incarcerate somebody at the front end. You know, in our county and city detention centers, people waiting for trial, people not being able to afford bail, all that is, we know that. A, do we know how much money that really is? B, if we're talking about it costing, let's say, $30 million, which is what the public defender's office is saying, it would cost to have enough lawyers to represent people at their bail hearings, because it's another question of police arrest policies, which is attached to this, but it's not even part of this conversation. Has anybody really sat down to say, if you spend X here now, we will save Y here, so it's a wash, maybe more than a wash?
I think it's a really difficult number to quantify, even though there have been studies by the Justice Policy Institute and other groups about the cost and impact of pretrial incarceration, particularly when you're trying to reconcile pretrial incarceration with a presumption of innocence in our country. But what the criminal defense lawyer knows is that it's not just the time that you're holding that person in a jail cell, which on average now most numbers are agreements of somewhere between $30,000 and $70,000 a year to house somebody in a jail cell. That's a college tuition right there. But
for a year.
Right, for a year. I
based
know.
On today's numbers, yeah. Exactly.
So, but what the criminal defense lawyer uniquely knows is the impact in terms of loss of jobs, loss of housing, loss of family connections, multitude of collateral damage that occurs when someone's held in. And then when you walk back into court and you get your stet or you get your probation and PBJ or a null pros, nobody's saying, I'm sorry for the damage that was done by holding your client in pretrial detention. And some magic of the system, this applies across the country because I've practiced in a few states, is just that the day that the judge is making the decision about whether to let your client go, he's public enemy number one and he's going to do all these bad things and he can't be in the community. But somehow when he enters a guilty plea, he magically becomes anointed and he's okay to leave the courthouse and the jail and he could be out amongst the community and his family again as long as he's on probation. Well, pretrial release services is much like a probation agency and they could do the same exact thing that a probation agent can do.
Pretrial has a check and a balance on what the commissioner does, and that's what the bail judge will do, the bail review judge. They're going to look at what bail the commissioner set in, and they're going to determine whether it's reasonable. As Chris said, they're going to have more information. The advantage that the defendant has is having a defense attorney there earlier, knowing the commissioner has less information. It does give the defendant a chance to present some of those issues. But as I said, it all comes down to implementation. We have had so many times in Maryland all these great plans and great ideas where there's just no money there. And if the money's not there, it's hard to see how it's practical.
But I guess that's why I was trying to push what I was pushing earlier about how people view if it's – some people can argue that if it's a constitutional right now in the state of Maryland to have a lawyer at bail, you have to find the money. You have to find some way to make it work, right?
Right, absolutely.
Tell that to the taxpayers.
Well, yeah, but that may be. I understand what you're saying, Tom. But you've got to find the money. It's like you can't not find the money to fund our schools. You can't. This is a constitutional mandate. You've got to find the money to figure out how people have the right to have a lawyer bail.
And I agree. From my perspective as a defense attorney, it provides my guys a chance to stay in their jobs. You know, and if we can do more of that, that's a good thing. I just hope that they're able to do that.
I think the other part of this discussion has to be the savings, because we're talking about the cost of pretrial incarceration, the cost of people losing jobs, and all that goes with the pretrial detention process. And when you have people getting out, being able to work and so forth, just the mere fact that many people become – and Ricardo can speak to this is that once they're in jail, they're presumptively qualified for a public defender. But if they're able to be out and working, then at least they have the chance of being able to hire their own attorney and not impose as much burden on the public defender's office. So there's a lot of cost benefits to having an attorney at the case at its inception. Not to say that many judges are not familiar with or don't impose the 10% bond, And if there's cases where there's going to be a bond forfeiture, at least that money will go back to the court when it does happen, as opposed to having a private bail bondsman have all the procedural safeguards that they have to make sure that even though on the books it might say that they're in danger to lose the money, they're really not going to likely lose the money because either the person gets rearrested and comes back in, or they're able to make a few phone calls because they don't run away. I remember in a baby judge school session that I was in with Doug Colbert, where he was presenting, one of the brand new judges said, well, I want a bail bondsman on this case because the bail bondsman can hop on a plane and find this guy in California, and he's not jurisdictionally tied to Baltimore. And one of the old salt judges spoke up and he said, you know what? That guy's going to be at his grandma's house or his mom's house right back in Baltimore where he lived his whole life. He ain't getting on a plane. He's not going to California. We don't need a bail bondsman to go find him.
We'll come back. I do want to get to this one. Go ahead, Tom.
I disagree with that. I think you have to have bail bondsmen involved. And Chris is right to an extent. A lot of times it's their insurance company that bears the risk, but they still have to pay those premiums. And they can lose their insurance if they have somebody on $1 million bail just skips out of town. I mean, these are just examples. But what they'll have to do is hire somebody like Dog the Bounty Hunter, whoever, in the state where they think the person is, and have them track them down. So they've actually got to pay that person to do it or give them part of the money that they are still collecting. So I don't think there's much incentive if you don't have a bail tied to the defendant.
But a lot of states don't. Like Kentucky has systems where you don't have – where bail bondsmen hardly have any work at all. And
so far, Kentucky, Illinois, Oregon, and Wisconsin have outlawed for-profit bail. Kentucky is probably the most recent to that list. I think 2011 is when they did it. It'll be interesting to see how the studies go down the line with that. But when you get back to the basics of why our clients come to the system in the first place, addiction, alcoholism, mental health issues, those are things that a pretrial services agency can do and start right at the beginning when a client is most motivated to change when they've gotten locked up and they don't want to go back into jail. A bail bondsman doesn't have any of those incentives. They just have one job: make sure this person goes back to court. Whether they reoffend, whether they keep using drugs or keep drinking themselves to death, not their concern. Their concern is to make sure they come back, and that's it. And they get a lot of help from getting people getting rearrested and so forth.
Ricardo, do you want to jump in this at all?
Well, I guess, I mean, certainly as an organization, the Office of the Public Defender is happy to see that people are coming around to really seeing money bail as a huge problem, and it's been an issue that's been discussed in Annapolis for many years. People see the Richmond 2 case as an opportunity to address things like money bond, along with the parts of the mandate that really have to be dealt with. But I think it's important to make that distinction. There are sort of discretionary spending opportunities wrapped up in Richmond 2, and then there are mandatory spending mandates. Actually eliminating bail bonds is one of the few alternatives that's being discussed, and a lot of them are out there, that doesn't necessarily have a price tag to it. I think what's interesting about the debate so far is that a lot of the alternatives to straight funding the public defender will end up costing the state more. For example, the creation of a statewide pretrial services that may or may not be operating on a 24/7 basis along with commissioners or district court judges to make those recommendations at initial appearances. And that ties in with the risk assessment conversation that I know you want to have. But my point is, you know, the taxpayer really needs to pay close attention to what's going to be happening in Annapolis, because I think it's, you know, very odd, if not unfair, for the powers to be to say on the one hand, we don't have $30 million to spend on public defenders, and then end up with a session that ends up spending more on some alternative. And so I think that's a real dynamic and a real perspective that people should keep an eye on.
So, I mean, it seems to me that no one has done the tough fiscal work just in terms of where the savings will come and how this can be paid for with lawyers at bail. In other words, what I'm saying is if all the studies show that you save money by having fewer people incarcerated, There's got to be some nuts and bolts people who can say, this is what you save. That's why spending $30 million to hire X number of public defenders to make sure this 24/7 lawyers at bail hearing can work financially, since it's now a constitutional mandate.
Yeah.
Is anybody doing that?
there are plenty of people within DBM and DLS that are waiting for specific proposals to analyze to that degree. Some of the cost savings analysis is inherently speculative. It's inherently context sensitive. But I think, as a general matter, you started part of this conversation talking about the cost savings. I think most people recognize that there's some degree. The question of whether it gets big enough to be a wash, I think, is the one that people really are obviously interested in, but I don't think there's any studies that show that. So it's more about measuring the costs against the benefits for each of these different proposals and deciding which amount of money to be spent makes the most sense economically, rationally, what sort of operations are most effective to implement this constitutional declaration.
So what do you think will happen, Chris Flora, Tom, politically on this in the very end?
I think that the delay is going to have to come to an end. It's a constitutional mandate. And what's going to happen is that finally we're going to have some little step forward, as there are a lot of small baby steps to get to this day, that that will have people have representation. Everybody assumes, having heard Miranda million times on the television, that people get an attorney right away. And then when they see what the reality is, they're shocked. And when the families come to you and say, I can't believe nobody was there. And in Baltimore City Central booking, it's like a hole. I mean, you can't, even a lawyer can't get in there for the commissioner hearing.
I have to
do it by fax.
It is a pit.
I can't be physically there with my client. I've been told in Baltimore County that I was a security risk and I couldn't appear with my client. So I had to make all these arguments, show them the law, show why I have to be in there, and so forth. But I think that what we're getting to finally is the basics of a person has a right to have an attorney right from the beginning. And now, because just as with everything, the yin and yang of the world, and it's a principle I really believe in, that when we get tight financially, we have to start looking at things in a different way. And when we start looking at alternatives of not locking everybody up for minor misdemeanor cases, not having everybody sit in pretrial detention on those cases where they're going to get out anyway. And then with the conversation that I'm welcoming to see, the bail reform.
So we have literally 30 seconds left here. We've got to end in the segment. So, Tom, I'll let you have 30 seconds here.
I think that he's absolutely right about where the money's coming from. But the fact is, in order for them to come to the court, there's got to be some incentive, or else you're going to have people just skipping out of the place. I mean, it's a subjective standard to say risk assessment. We think that they're not going to be trouble.
We will come back to risk assessment for the entire discussion, and we'll take a very close look at the four or five states that have implemented this and see how they do and how that affects Maryland. And we were encouraging you all to come down to the Annapolis Summit on January the 8th, we will ask these questions of the governor and the president and the speaker of the House, president of the Senate, that is, and for our January the summit. And this is how you can come. Gentlemen, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you, Mark.
We've been
here,
Mark.
With Chris Flohr, who's the former legal director of Lawyers at Bail Project, now in private practice at Blackford and Flohr, Ricardo Flores, director of government relations at the Maryland Office of the Public Defender, and Tom Mavronik, host of the Tom Moore Show on WCBM and a criminal defense attorney. Thank you all for being here. And this is how you can come to the Annapolis Summit. Every year on the opening day of the Maryland General Assembly, we convene the Annapolis Summit, where I interview the governor, Speaker of the House, and the Senate president. And this is your chance to have your voice heard and ask your questions of our state leaders. So please join me, join us, Wednesday, January the 8th, from 7 to 10 a.m. in Annapolis. And reserve your seat now. Just go to www.steinershow.org, S-T-E-I-N-E-R, show.org, and click on the banner at the top of the page for ticket information. Join us in Annapolis. The Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Mark Gunnery and Stephanie Mavronis. Our engineer is Andre Melton. To hear the show again, podcast past shows, and find out information about our guests and the work they do, please visit us on the web at steinershow.org. And you can also listen to and download our podcast on iTunes. For Public Radio, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.